The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Women's Health Watch of October 2023, and then probably later on from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And the first thing I'm going to do is to finish up a article about the treatment of breast cancer, which I had started on the most recent health issues. And I'm going to continue it this time. This is from the Harvard Women's Health Letter of October 2023. Continuing, there are reasons for optimism. In coming years, nascent technologies not yet in widespread use are likely to hit the mainstream, Dr. Burstein says. These include so-called liquid biopsies, blood tests that look for the presence or absence of DNA from tumor cells in the bloodstream. The test results will help us decide who needs more or less treatment based on circulating cell tumor DNA, he says. Many women with metastatic breast cancer, which isn't yet curable, now thrive for many years as a parade of new treatments extend their lives while bolstering energy levels and the ability to live more normally. Patients are living longer and doing better with metastatic breast cancer, Dr. Burstein says. It's fair to say most women will live for many years after that diagnosis, and many are likely to be treated with drugs that don't exist today because progress is happening so quickly. Women who have been diagnosed with breast cancer can help maximize treatment results with these strategies. First, you need to seek a multidisciplinary care team, blending clinicians in medical oncology, radiology, surgery, genetics, and other specialties. This care model promotes collaboration that can lead to better outcomes for women with early stage breast cancer. Patient navigation and social work services can also be valuable parts of a multidisciplinary team. Go to a center where everyone is familiar with each other, Dr. Burstein says. Women with early stage disease almost always need surgery, medications, and radiation, so it's important the team works together. Don't take a passive role in your treatment. While your care team may possess great expertise, clinicians may not understand your personal priorities or concerns. Make sure your questions are being answered by the team so you understand where things are and where they're going, he says. There's a small section that's entitled Types of Breast Cancer. Breast cancer types are typically named for the kind of hormone receptors present in tumor cells. Knowing the type enables doctors to choose the most appropriate treatment. The first is ER positive. That means the cancer cells contain hormone receptors for estrogen. Then there is HER2 positive. The cancer cells have high numbers of receptors for HER2, a protein that fuels cancer growth. And ER negative, HER2 negative, means a cancer cell that doesn't contain receptors for estrogen or HER2. Then there's triple negative, cells that don't have receptors for estrogen, progesterone, or HER2. There's also a brief section that's entitled, Without a Telltale Lump, Inflammatory Breast Cancer Can Be Deceiving and Deadly. If your breast seems red or swollen, feels unusually warm, or the skin has thickened or dimpled, don't pass it off as a bug bite or a heat rash. Even without a discernible lump, breast cancer could be the culprit. There's a form of the disease called inflammatory breast cancer, or IBC, which is responsible for just 1 to 5% of all cases. and shows up very differently from most breast cancers. Because it's so rare and initial signs are easy to miss, many women are not on the lookout for IBC, but they should be, says Dr. Philippa Lintz, director of the Inflammatory Breast Cancer Section at the Harvard-affiliated Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. IBC is especially dangerous because symptoms often develop rapidly, over a few weeks or months. By then, the disease is already at an advanced stage because cancer cells have grown into the skin. Someone wakes up and notices her breasts feel heavier. A couple of weeks later, she may notice redness. Then the skin around her nipples looks like the skin of an orange. It's all relatively quick. Many women with such symptoms are treated with antibiotics, since their symptoms can resemble a breast infection. A doctor may also attribute symptoms to an allergic reaction. A diagnosis that's missed or delayed is one of the challenges associated with this disease, Dr. Lintz says. Don't wait to see a doctor, especially if these signs don't quickly resolve. Diagnosing IBC involves breast imaging, like a mammogram, which is often followed by an ultrasound and examination of nearby lymph nodes and or a breast MRI. A biopsy is required to confirm the diagnosis. Any woman who develops inflammatory changes in the breast, even without a lump, should understand it can be cancer. If your symptoms don't resolve right away with a short course of antibiotics, don't sit on it. Further workup is needed. Now we're going to stick with the Harvard Women's Health Watch from October 2023. We're going to look at an article called Staying in Shape, a case of use it or lose it. Our fitness can quickly diminish if we stop exercising. Here's how to safely get back in the game. Everybody needs a little time away from jobs, people, and even exercise. But if you stayed fit and strong from diligent regular workouts, it's astonishing how quickly it can all slip away if you take weeks or months off, either voluntarily or because of illness or injury. Beyond losing exercise immediate benefits, including sounder sleep and stress relief, the disadvantage of stopping becomes readily apparent. The phenomenon is called deconditioning, and it happens to both recreational exercisers and elite athletes. Certain factors influence how quickly you'll lose strength and endurance, including age, prior fitness level, and any medical condition. But it's universal, says Dr. Beth Freites, a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at the Harvard Medical School. It will happen no matter who you are, Dr. Freites says. We say exercise is medicine, and it's true. When you take the medicine, or in this case, do the exercise, you reap the benefits, but it's use it or lose it. What does it mean to lose fitness, and how quickly does it erode? That depends on the category. Cardiovascular fitness is the fastest to decline. Within a few days of our last aerobic exercise session, our hearts pump less blood around the body, and the blood that's circulating to cells and muscles will contain less oxygen. Only a few weeks later, you'll find yourself huffing and puffing to complete the same brisk walk, cycling route, or swim routine you'd once done with ease. Your heart might be pounding, too. Perhaps you'll notice you can't talk while you're walking up that hill like you did 4 weeks ago. Something that was moderate intensity exercise for you before is now vigorous, and you might feel like stopping earlier. Muscle strength takes longer to lose, about 2 months. You won't be able to lift as much or do as many repetitions as before your hiatus. The same weight or body resistance exercise will prove far more fatiguing, and your muscles will likely feel extremely sore. The good news? Muscle memory is real, meaning shrunken muscle fibers can indeed rebound, Dr. Freites says. you can get back to muscle strengthening a little more quickly than you can get back to the same level of cardiovascular conditioning, she says. The first step in getting fit again is believing you can do it. There's no question it'll get harder before it gets easier, Dr. Freight says. No one has a precise equation for how long it will take a particular person to regain fitness. The longer you are away from it, the longer it will take. It will not happen immediately. It will take at least several weeks. Dr. Freights offers this guidance for safely rebooting your exercise routine. Get your doctor's okay. This is crucial. If you haven't exercised in a long time, many months or years, or have chronic conditions like heart disease or diabetes, and if you experience any alarming symptoms when first exercising, like chest pain or pressure, stop immediately and seek medical attention. Instead of reverting to your toughest workouts, try lighter activities or weight levels to get comfortable moving again. Don't go off and do sprints at the track on your first day. Build up slowly. Even taking a walk can help. Do what worked before. Perhaps you felt on top of your fitness when you took group classes or biked dozens of miles a week. So ease into doing it again. Think back to when you were routine, consistent, and successful, and consider using a similar strategy this time around, Dr. Freight says. We learned as children that movement can be fun. If you loved hula hooping or paddleboarding when you were younger, consider returning to it. Accountability partners aren't a new idea, but they work, which is why getting an exercise buddy should be the top of mind when you're resuming a regimen. If you don't have a ready workout buddy, consider working with a health coach. Track your progress. Wearable devices can fuel renewed exercise efforts by tracking step count, resting heart rate, and other metrics. But an old-school pen and paper log can also do the trick. You can look at how you did and make adjustments. If week one doesn't go the way you wanted, there's no shame or guilt. This is definitely a case where some exercise is better than none. Now, here's a couple of short articles, again in the Harvard Women's Health Watch of October 2023, in the area called Research We're Watching. The first one is entitled, Higher BMI Associated with Greater Odds of Joint Disease. A higher body mass index, or BMI, is one of the major risk factors for developing osteoarthritis. But a new study suggests that carrying extra weight can also make it more likely a person will experience an inflammatory joint condition like rheumatoid arthritis. The study, published online May 23, 2023, by the journal Arthritis and Rheumatology, involved 362,000 adults participating in the UK Biobank, a large biomedical database. Researchers analyzed how participants' BMI, a calculation of body size that considers height and weight, related to their likelihood of developing five joint conditions. And these were rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, psoriatic arthritis, gout, and inflammatory spondylitis. Other than osteoarthritis, most other joint diseases are driven by inflammation. Participants with higher BMIs, significantly greater than the normal BMI range of 18.5 to 24.9, had higher rates of rheumatoid arthritis, 52%, osteoarthritis, 49%, psoriatic arthritis, 80%, gout, 73%, and inflammatory spondylitis, 34%. Compared with people in the normal BMI range. Weight control can help reduce the risk of developing a joint disease, the study authors concluded. And here's another interesting brief article. Hormone therapy is linked to higher risks of GERD. Women who have used hormone therapy for menopausal symptoms may be more likely to develop gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD, a new analysis suggests. The study, published online June 27, 2023, by the journal Menopause, analyzed data from five earlier studies involving 1 million women, none of whom have been diagnosed with GERD before the study's start. Researchers found that participants who were current or past users of hormone therapy for relieving menopausal symptoms were 29% more likely overall to develop GERD, which is characterized by heartburn, difficulty swallowing, and chest pain. Women who used estrogen alone had a 41% higher odds of GERD, while progesterone-only hormone therapy was linked to a 39% higher risk. Hormone therapy combining estrogen and progesterone was associated with only a 16% higher risk. The study was observational, meaning it couldn't prove that hormone therapy causes GERD, only that there is an association. Female hormones are believed to relax the muscles that control the lower esophageal sphincter, allowing stomach acid to flow back up into the esophagus. Women considering hormone therapy should review their other risk factors for GERD and make necessary lifestyle changes, including quitting smoking, maintaining a healthy weight, and not lying down after eating heavy meals, the study authors said. And now we're going to turn to the Mayo Clinic health letter. This is the October 2023 issue. And let's start with a section called Second Opinion. And this consists of some questions and answers. And the first question is, I've known two people who had heart attacks recently while they were sick, one with COVID-19 and the other with flu. Are these infections that hard on the body? And the answer from the Mayo Clinic health letter is, it's probably not a coincidence. The COVID-19 pandemic was an all-too-real reminder that viral infections, including flu and respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, can cause serious health problems and can even be deadly. In addition to causing lung problems and general sickness, these infections also unleash an assault on the cardiovascular system. Several studies have shown that some upper respiratory infections, including COVID-19, flu, and RSV, increase the risk of cardiovascular events like heart attacks by 12 to 15%. This risk may be even higher with certain infections or in people at higher risk of heart problems. This includes those who have one or more risk factors for heart disease, like diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, unhealthy cholesterol, or liver disease. However, for those who have gotten available vaccines, the risk of infection and subsequent heart trouble drops. In people with cardiovascular risk factors, full COVID-19 vaccination is associated with a 41% reduction in major heart events from COVID-19. Even partial vaccination is associated with a 24% reduced risk. Staying current with flu shots is associated with a 25% reduced risk. As flu season rolls around, the Mayo Clinic experts urge older adults to obtain all recommended vaccines. These may include an annual flu shot, a COVID-19 booster, and a new RSV vaccine approved for older adults. And then there's a question, I often go along to my husband's visits with his healthcare team. We don't always understand the care instructions and sometimes come home without important details. Is it okay to record the visits? Recording medical visits has become more common since most people now own phones that can easily capture video and audio. People can benefit from being able to play back instructions later at their own pace to fill gaps in understanding. This can save time, reduce mistakes, and improve outcomes. The question of whether it's appropriate often comes down to the comfort level with your healthcare team. Most states have laws that allow you to make recordings even if other people in the room don't approve or know that they're being recorded. In 12 states, the law allows recordings to be made, but only with the prior approval of those being recorded. Beyond the legal question is one of privacy and individual choice. Healthcare facilities often have their own policies that govern the use of recording devices. For example, the Mayo Clinic bans the use of hidden recording devices and requires you to get the consent of medical professionals before recording clinic interactions. It's important to have a trusting relationship with your care team. To further that trust, let your team know if you plan to record. Some may want to discuss restrictions, especially about keeping footage private. In any case, informing in advance tends to be the best route to promote cooperation. There are other steps you can take to make sure that you understand critical visit information. Bring a paper and pen to take notes. Ask a member of your care team to write down specific instructions, or print a summary from your medical record. Repeat what you've understood and ask for confirmation that it's correct. Now here's an article in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter called Couples Counseling. You've been having the same fight with your spouse once a month, every month, for the past 30 years. While having coffee with a friend, you tell her about the latest iteration of this fight, and she asks if you've ever considered marriage counseling. Your reaction may be to take offense. My marriage isn't that bad. Maybe you think there's no way you could talk your spouse into it. Or maybe you think, isn't it a little late for that? Richard Owens Jr., LPC, a psychotherapist from Mayo Clinic, knows from experience that even people who have been partnered for decades can benefit from professional relationship therapy. It's never too late to learn, grow, heal, and improve, he says. A question I may ask, would you like the next X years to be different? Or do you want to live another X years the way you have lived the previous X years? There are some obvious reasons to turn to therapy, like the discovery of an affair. But therapies don't have to be the last resort. There are many other reasons to consider therapy. The first is communication challenges. A couple may have certain issues that repeatedly cause miscommunication, conflicts, fights, or avoidance. Oswald says, sometimes it can help to have a professional third party work through these sticking points. Also, changing roles and identities. Advancing age can bring changes in your professional roles, social groups, and identity. When one or both partners retire, huge shifts can occur in the amount of time spent together. Expectations about household responsibilities or the amount of disposable income, all of which can lead to relationship issues. Chronic illnesses like cancer or any situation where one partner becomes a caregiver can significantly strain a relationship. The aging or death of a parent can also be stressful. These life events add stress, confusion, and grief, Oswald says. Partners can deal with these things in different ways and sometimes not understand the other or feel that the other is against them. Additionally, the Mayo Clinic experts point out specific signs that couples therapy may be a good idea. You aren't talking to your partner, or talk is often negative or adversarial. You're afraid to talk to your partner because you're not sure what their reaction will be and don't feel that you'll be heard or supported. You start to see your partner as an opponent rather than a teammate, perhaps when it comes to dividing up household tasks and chores. You feel stuck doing the same problematic things over and over in your relationship and are ready to address the underlying issues driving that repeated behavior. Even when you both agree to therapy, your relationship may not automatically improve. It takes both parties to agree to do the work for a healthy relationship. But therapy can provide the opportunity and the help to be a healthier person if you choose, and your partner has the same choice. Similarly, Oswald cautions against going into therapy thinking, if my partner would just blank, then everything would be okay. The other person's not the problem. There's a problem that the two people can work to identify, address, and solve if they want to. You have your own stuff that makes the relationship what it is. You are not off the hook, believe it or not, even for affairs. Still, therapy can help in many ways with the relationship, Oswald says, like creating a deeper connection between partners, resolving long-term hurt, and enabling better communication. Therapy can also allow for more enjoyable and satisfying sexual intimacy and foster greater self-confidence. To find a therapist, you can ask your healthcare team for suggestions or referrals, or visit websites like the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy at aamft.org, or the American Psychological Association at locator, that's locator, .apa.org, for provider directories. You may have to meet with multiple therapists to find the best fit for you. Ultimately, you can't make anyone go to counseling. Going by yourself and discussing relationship issues can still be helpful. By definition, relationships change when just one person changes. Working on yourself is all you have control over. Whether you do this with your partner in the room or not, it will benefit the relationship. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.